Reality Myth Symbol, which is a short paper, and my thing on it is very short. This paper was written for a conference in Boston on these three topics, myth, symbol, and reality, I think this was called, so Lonnie just turned the order around in his own lecture, reality, myth, symbol. So he was asked to say what he thinks about these things, and he said it very, very cryptically, or at least in very short compass. He was very tired at this time, you know, some of his papers are quite short. Anyway, each of these three terms, he says, gives rise to questions. And while the questions are different, they can be addressed in fundamentally the same style with the same method. Take out the word of, right? With the same method. Reality. Well, why do there arise questions about reality? Well, one of the reasons is just human confusion, but there can be a deeper philosophical reason for problems about reality. Namely, people live in two worlds, the world of immediacy and the world mediated by meaning. And the criteria for success in those two worlds are quite different. We do appeal to criteria in the world of immediacy at certain times, you know, to escape danger and that sort of thing. But the world of immediacy and the world mediated by meaning and values, mediated by meaning and motivated by values, employ different criteria. The criteria employed in coming to know the world mediated by meaning and in coming to behave in the world motivated by values are quite novel when contrasted with the more spontaneous criteria that suffice for orienting oneself in the world of immediacy. There's the whole criteria in the world world mediated by meaning and motivated by values. The criteria are set by the questions that we raise. Those questions set the standards that must be met. So he quickly runs through a series of modern philosophers to show how complex this question is, how it gets confused in Berkeley and it gets confused in Kant and so on and so forth. But for Lonergan, it is the immanent criteria of the knowing subject. It is in the immanent criteria of the knowing subject that we may perhaps manage to discover why there are many opinions about reality, and even which is probably the correct opinion. So again, it's this turn to the subject and coming to appropriate what are the immanent criteria in our coming to know. The importance of everything that his life's work is all about. These criteria are found in questions for intelligence, questions for reflection, and questions for deliberation. So, I mean, basically saying to address the problems about reality that are raised because of the confusion over the two worlds of immediacy and the world mediated by meaning, might do well to read a book like Insight, you know, because Insight will point you to the criteria for answering those questions. All right, then the term myth. Myth has been used in many different ways. In Insight itself, Lonergan used the term in a very pejorative sense and contrasted it with mystery. Myth was our tendency to present symbolic expressions of counterpositions, whereas mystery was our effort to present in symbolic form basically positional elements or positional stances. The term myth is used here now in a more neutral sense. It alludes to our propensity to tell stories that allow us to acknowledge in some way what is obscure about the world. So he says when we reach things that somehow we know something about but not enough to give any kind of theoretical account, well, we revert to telling stories. But stories, he says, are existential. There are true stories that reveal the life that we are really leading, and this would be the value for him of something like narrative theology. Okay. But there are also cover stories that make out our lives to be somewhat better than in reality they are. And sometimes we can catch ourselves telling cover stories about you know, our behavior. So stories today and the myths of yesterday suffer from a basic ambiguity. They can bring to light what truly is human, and they can also propagate an apparently more pleasant view of human aspiration and human destiny. Now, I'm just suggesting that it's in these comments on myth that perhaps some of what René Girard has to say about the ambiguity of myth as a cover story for violence that could be inserted. It's just a suggestion. And then it's symbols. It's in symbols that we find the roots of the hunches that myths delineate. And at this point, he's referring to Ira Progoff. I put him onto those books of Progoff that he's referring to there, the Psychology in Modern Man and The Death and Rebirth of Psychology. He found Progoff quite enlightening. And then Progoff, it's like Lonergan and Gendlin. When Gendlin found out that Lonergan liked his stuff, they started corresponding. Mm-hmm. And Progoff was also quite excited to find out that Lonergan was reading him and quoting him. And they had some correspondence. Okay, so I know I'm telescoping the discussion quite a bit, but all three questions, number 15, are resolved in some way by appealing to intentionality analysis, and this is what he's trying to get at in his paper, 387. It, namely intentionality analysis, reduces conflicting views of reality to the very different types of intentionality employed by the infant, the infans, literally non-speaking, the infans that does not talk, and the adult that lives in a world mediated by meaning and motivated by values. It, intentionality analysis, accounts for the oddity of the myth by arguing that being human is a being in the world, an in der Welt sein, that one can rise to full stature only through full knowledge of the world, yet that one does not possess that full knowledge, and so appeals to the élan vital, another word for that passionateness of being, a tidal movement, appealing to that, that as it guides biological growth and evolution, so too it takes the lead in human development and expresses its intimations through the stories it inspires. This was the big issue for Plato, to distinguish the myth that told a true story and the myth that was a cover story. Symbols, finally, are a more elementary type of story. They are inner or outer events, or a combination of both, that intimate to us at once the kind of being that we are to be, that we can be, and the kind of world in which we become our true selves. So it's not a tremendously illuminating, or it's not a tremendously complex picture that he's presenting here. Then he gives the brief story of his own development and how he arrived at his views, but I think we've seen that. We saw a lot of that in Insight Revisited at the very beginning of the course. And then finally he ends with the threefold conversion and then leading to the fourth conversion, the psychic conversion, as a development on that. I don't really want to say more about it in terms of lecturing. I'd just like to throw it open for discussion.
I don't have the book here, and I forget the term exactly, but there was two terms I think he used, dyna and cognitive.
Oh, yeah, dynatypes and cognitypes. Yeah. That's in Progoff.
I just didn't know what that meant.
And I didn't give him that. I gave him Progoff to read, but then it's one of the things that he found, because I didn't use those terms. It's on page 390 in the book. It's the Collected Works, Volume 17 book. For Progoff, the élan vital, the passionateness of being, the tidal movement, the thing that he's referred to in a number of these papers, has two manifestations. There, and Progoff calls them dynatypes and cognotypes. Cognotypes are the symbols, for instance, that arise in our dreams. But the dynatypes are the root of the lifestyles to which we're attracted. They're more undifferentiated. They're more primordial than the cognotypes. Cognotypes have a cognitive significance to them already. Even a symbol in a dream, there's something cognitive about it, and it's leading you to know something. Mm-hmm. But there's a whole predilection of each person for a certain way. I would say that probably, if there's anything to the Myers-Briggs, the Myers-Briggs would be talking about dynatypes. Or again, if there's anything to the Enneagram would be talking about dynatypes. That were dispositions into certain ways of relating, feeling.
So even though in your life there's certain events that injure you, you know, still that dynatype would determine how we react, how we protect ourselves. There would be different ways that different dynatypes would do that.
I think as I understand what Progoff is saying, that's what it would be. And different people do things differently. They're kind of almost programmed differently. Wired differently.
Yeah. So would that be genetics, or is there any?
Yeah, I think it probably is genetics. I think it is the roots of it. You know. But genetics now become conscious.
Yeah.
Because it's very primordial, conscious dispositions to behave in certain ways. But the examples that I can think of just by looking at how he's disengaged what Progoff means by dynamics would be Myers-Briggs and the Enneagram. People are different in ways that it's not saying that one's better than the other or anything like that.
No.
It's just that different people are wired to respond in different ways under certain circumstances.
Well, and I wonder if the cognotypes would somehow be related to the dynatypes.
Oh, yeah,
in terms
definitely.
Of,
the dynatypes, you know, like, are the roots of the cognotypes.
But actual grace, you know, that you need this to develop in this kind of way, and these kinds of symbols emerge for you.
For you. Yeah. Good. And you can see that, but that's certainly what happens in retreat circumstances, you know. One of the things when I started, I did some work back 30 years ago in directing individual retreats. I haven't done that kind of stuff for at least the last 20 years, but the impression, the thing that hit me so much as I was starting out on that is if you're directing five or six people at the same time, you know, is that one after another, the issues that they're dealing with are so different, and the ways that God is dealing with them are so different, you know. And yet it's all grace. And you know, God knows their dynatypes, and so God will deal with them in those terms. There's also, if what I'm talking about, if what I'm using here, say Myers-Briggs or which is basically Jungian typology, extrovert, introvert, and then the four functions, or the Enneagram, if there's any value to those, and I don't know how far I would want to go with either one of them, but there are also dangers connected with the dynatypes, that if you don't balance them off against something else, you know, you can, in the Enneagram, the one can be given to such perfectionism that he or she becomes either proud or very overly harsh on themselves or overly judgmental of other people or whatever. Bill McNichols, you know, who did the icon, is a four. And he goes on about fours, you know, and he loves to just talk about, you can't do that to me because I'm a four. But he's all joking. Don't talk to me like that. I'm a four. Don't ask me to do that.
I wonder what Jesus was.
So that's I know I'm ending my comments early, but this.
Well, I know this question is really, I should not make it if, because I'm in a course of insight, but and that's the basic of insight, but I still see that there's a big issue for Lonergan, and he, I think he approached that in chapter 14 of Insight, between the world of immediacy and the world mediated by me. It's a very basic thing, but it's the world mediated by meaning you enter it, you are part of it as an adult. Is there anything you can experience in the world of immediacy that I know of is the mystical experience. But is there anything else where you are constantly in a world of immediacy, of just without using symbols, without using culture, without using nothing to access reality?
Mm. He talks here about, first of all, let me just say, Insight itself, the book Insight, does not use the expressions world of immediacy and world mediated by me. That's something that he's talking about. That the distinction between thing and body is orientation to body is world of immediacy. The orientation to the thing is world mediated by meaning. But it's later on when he's attempting to relate his thought to thought about language and so on, that this distinction, the explicit distinction between the world of immediacy and the world mediated by meaning, arises. When the infant learns language, the infant moves into the world mediated by meaning.
Mm-hmm.
So we move into it with language, because language opens up a world that is not immediately present. Okay, my niece, when she was 3 years old, tell me another story. And she was endless. I need to hear stories. But it was the entrance into the world mediated by meaning.
Did you tell her that, Bob?
No, I didn't. Language does that. It moves you out so that you're no longer exclusively in the world of immediacy. But we all live in both worlds, you know? And there are instincts for self-preservation, for instance, that can take over when you're in a situation where your life is in danger and you just like that, you know? It's a world of immediacy. It's a knee-jerk reaction, which works. It works.
So where does that knowing come from? Is it back to Dharma types and...
It's a good question, you know? I would say that what's involved in it is definitely more than just feeling and the experience of sense data. That,
because you do make a decision to act.
Yeah, but it's all like that, you know.
It might help you. I see. Let me just introduce the terms image. And sign to symbol here.
Right.
So image roughly corresponds with experience. It's a phantasm, really. And then symbol corresponds roughly, I think, with understanding. But you see, and then a sign is more abstract. So that's usually going to involve judgment, I think. So the image, symbol, and sign roughly correspond with the structure. But what really confuses me is, can a symbol be encountered in the world of immediacy? I've got a definition here of symbol. It's an image that embodies a concrete and particular meaning.
Well, see, in Method, he defines a symbol a little differently from that. In Method, it's an image of a real or imaginary object that evokes a feeling, or is evoked by a feeling. So he's using symbol in that sense there, which fits very much in terms of like dream symbols. Dream symbols very much are accommodated to that definition that he gives in Method and Theology. And he says I just finished the lectures that we've put out on CD, the lectures that we just put out on CD, on Method and Theology from Boston College in 1968, he says quite clearly that he's not using symbol the way some people use it, namely as exclusively linguistic. So symbol for Lonergan is pre-linguistic. It can be informed by meaning. I mean, certainly when I, at age whatever, 35, have an archetypal symbol in my dream, well, it's informed by the whole education, including linguistic education, that I've had up to that point. But and it's functioning as a symbol, it's prior to insight and conceptualization and formulation on my part, which will give rise to a new word. So it's prior to linguistification. And that's the sense in which he's using it, is that, that prior element of meaning. So now your question was, is the symbol purely in the world of immediacy?
Yeah, I mean, I understand that it's pre-linguistic, but how far can you push the symbol back, so to speak? In a biological pattern of experience and insight, you can encounter a body, and it can evoke a feeling. I mean, would it be right to say that, you know, touching the stove and withdrawing your hand is evoking a feeling? I think he's using it more in the sense of an apprehension of value. The symbol, it seems to me, it's got to be bound up with feeling responding to value. Otherwise, you can say, you know, everything I bump into is a symbol. In
oh,
a way.
Okay. But yeah. let's take the example that you just gave. You could have a dream of yourself getting too close to a stove. All right. Now, that dream does not mean that you're getting too close to the stove. It means you're getting too close to danger, and you could be better be careful. So there is a meaning, there's a symbolic meaning to it. It's not telling you to stay away from stoves, but it is telling you to stay away from, then you have to figure out, well, okay, what's the stove? You know? So it is symbolic. It could be symbolic of that. So, there is a relationship to values, and this is something that I've drawn out in my initial stuff when talking about psychic conversion, is that values, feelings, are the mediating thing here. If you simply take Lonergan's definition of symbol as the image of a real or imaginary object that evokes a feeling or is evoked by a feeling, you've got the relationship of symbols to feelings right there. And then you take his understanding of values, that values are apprehended in feelings. Then you can, from those two statements, you can relate symbols to values. And what connects them are feelings. So that to follow a person's elemental symbols through a certain point in one's life is really to follow the existential development of the person as living in a world motivated by values. So it is related to that. And that's what a realistic account of a critical realistic account of depth psychology would have that kind of emphasis on in it. Which is why Lonergan found one of the books that I lent him to read, which he quotes in third collection, is Gerhard Adler's The Living Symbol, which traces the dreams and active imaginations of a woman in Jungian analysis over the course of a year. But makes very clear, not using Lonergan's language at all, that all of this is tied up with existential value living, value issues in her living. To see these all connected with one another. And then there's the dream that I had when I was in Zurich, which I've related in a couple of things, about going down into the basement. You know the one, that dream? I was going down into the basement of a house, and the house was very much like a house that I was living in Zurich, a Jesuit community, a house about the size of our house on Isabella Street, a little larger. And I was going down into the basement. Well, of course, what I was doing in Zurich was trying to understand the relationship of Lonergan to Jung. Lonergan's always going up, and Jung's always going down. And here I am, I'm going down into the basement. So I'm going down into the unconscious. And who's coming up the stairs but Lonergan? And he turns to me and he says, now, if you really want to see some symbols, come with me. And he takes me up to the top floor the fourth level, you see, and a movie starts to show. And we go into this large room, and it's just the two of us, and we're sitting next to each other, and interestingly enough, I'm to his left, and we're watching this movie, and the movie, and the dream ends at that point. But what he's saying is, yeah, you can go down, but you got to bring these things up. You go down and you just wallow around in the basement. You're just, that's not the meaning of it. The meaning of the dream symbol is your existential living. So you bring it up, you interpret it, which is second level. You interpret it as accurately as you can, which is third level. And you what is this saying about the world motivated by values, you know? So it's interesting. It was interesting that he took me to the top floor of the house.
What was the significance about sitting on to his left?
I'm not sure. You know, maybe there's a significance and maybe there isn't. But politically, I'm more to the left than he was.
I
don't know.
I heard that story in Colombia, so that's why I smile when you said it.
About the dream?
Yeah.
Because I put it in a couple of articles.
Yeah.
But that was a breakthrough for me to the relationship between Lauren and Jung. Because I knew that, I mean, they're both talking about elements of interiority, but how are they related to each other? And that was the image that gave me the insight to, you know. So, interesting. Mm-hmm.
Well, would you say that you trace the development of symbol in Lonergan, that you could say that in the period, let's say, of insight is pretty much an element of the cognitive operation. And then in method, when he kind of relates it to the affect and the internal communication that he speaks of.
Internal communication. Symbol.
It sounds to me to be very existential. And it's only later on in the post-method period where it seems to me that the symbol takes on a historical element of us. So that when you speak of being in the world and the context within which we are immersed in, so the appropriation, the historical appropriation of the human subject involves a lot of that symbolic element, I think. Would that be an accurate?
I think so. Now, let me go back to the insight thing, though, because in the discussion of mystery and myth in chapter 17, that's more than cognitive, because he speaks about the need that we have for symbols that open us into the unknown. So, and that's what genuine mystery is. So it's more than knowing. But his main thing in insight is the image, symbol, and so on as the phantasm into which insight is at. So it's the cognitive form. Yes.
One small little comment. I think we're over, right, or something? I don't know.
I'm just going to depart 10 minutes early, if that's okay. I have another class.
Okay.
Sorry, excuse me.
I thought it was five.
We're done
with
this. We're fine.
Gordon Rickson in his class was trying to say that Lonergan was much interested in mysticism and the religious experience of mysticism in his later times.
Right.
But looking at the writings, it looks like he still kept progressing in the lines of method, and he was much worried about this dialogue about religion and religious studies, and he's going more not to the fifth level, but I see him exploring a lot of your intuitions or your insights. I'm sorry about psychic conversion and about the consciousness. So how do I join all this? He didn't write much about mysticism in his lectures or something, or because it's, you know, I go to Gordon Rickson's class and I feel like, oh my God, Lonergan was very much into mysticism at the end of his times, and I see his writings are very scientific, are very, you know, he's talking about method, he's talking about history, he's talking about the development of man. He's talking about religious science, studying religion.
But he does say that, you know, if you want to know what religious involvement is, mm-hmm. go to the mystics. Mm-hmm. They're the ones. Go to the mystics. And if you want to know whether there's anything in common between different religious traditions, mm-hmm. go to the mystics of the different religious traditions and see if they might be talking about something that's in common, that they have in common with one another. So there is that. He is fascinated with mysticism. He doesn't give you a theology of mysticism, you know, but he's fascinated with it and points to the importance of it. I don't know what more to say about that. I mean, I think Gordon's right that he was very engaged with the subject of mysticism. You know, sometimes when he found something that satisfied him, he would just indicate it. So he'll point you to William Johnston's work, for instance, and to and he says in one point that Johnston's work expresses views that are very, very much the same as mine. So in other words, I don't have to repeat it. Somebody else did it. And the mysticism of the cloud of unknowing and a couple of other things. I don't know what else to say.
Okay,
well, we don't have to stick to the 4 o'clock. And if we're done, we're done. Yeah. And next week, Mary Jo, good luck. Okay. And that will be it. Thank you.
Isn't that something?
Thank you.
Thank you. There we are.